Hello and welcome to Baylor Connections, a conversation series with the people shaping our future. Each week we go in-depth with Baylor leaders, professors, and more, discussing important topics in higher education, research, and student life. I'm Derek Smith, and our guest today is Monique Ingalls. Dr. Ingalls is an ethnomusicologist and assistant professor of music at Baylor and the Center for Christian Music Studies. A rising star researcher at Baylor, her research is focused on a number of topics, ranging from music's role in shaping religious community to the influence of digital technology in worship. Last year, she released the book Singing the Congregation, How Contemporary Worship Music Forms Evangelical Community. Been traveling back and forth between the States and England for your research, among other places, and appreciate you making time to be with us here on Baylor Connections today. Dr. Monique Ingalls, welcome to the program.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, it's great to have you here. And again, as we talk about your research, it's a very active and ongoing. You've had conferences. You've been traveling back and forth across the pond, as they say, to do some research.
Yeah, I spent the first 6 weeks of this summer in the UK conducting research on my new project on British gospel choirs, and then immediately went back to had five conferences between now and the end of July. I'm headed back next week for another conference, and then things should, on the travel front, things should quiet down in August as prepare for classes to start.
Well, and your department and center, the Center for Christian Music Studies, y'all recently finished up the Alleluia Conference. We had Dr. Randall Bradley on the program a while back, but for people who don't know, what is the Alleluia Conference and why is it such a big deal in that world?
Absolutely. Well, the Alleluia Conference brings church music practitioners from around the state and increasingly around the country, even around the world. We had several international visitors this year to talk about things of interest and of practical application for people leading church music. You know, we talk about current trends and issues, things that are changing in the world of church music. We introduce people to a variety of resources. One of the things that I especially appreciate about the Alleluia Conference is that there's something there for people across Christian traditions and across a wide variety of musical styles and song repertories. My own research and interest has been in the area of contemporary worship music, so pop rock bands and so on. So a lot of the sessions that I teach are related to that, whereas there are also wonderful sessions on choral music, on organ literature, on, playing the piano in a variety of styles, you know, kind of piano being the bridge sometimes between classical choral music and then more contemporary styles. So it's just a wonderful time to get together. I think for some people it's a reunion of sorts. Mm-hmm. They look forward to coming every year and learning from these world-class practitioners and scholars, as well as fellowshipping with other people who are going through the same things in their churches.
We are visiting with Dr. Monique Ingalls, assistant professor of music at Baylor, and you mentioned your research as we're talking about the Alleluia Conference. Let's dive into that a little bit. But first, let me ask you, what exactly do we mean when we use the term ethnomusicologist, and how does that extend beyond what we might know as traditional methods of studying congregational music?
That's a good question, and one that, as you can imagine, I get about every time I tell someone I'm an ethnomusicologist. So think of just the term, you know, musicologist, one who studies music. And ethnos, in the broader sense, meaning nation or culture. You know, so someone who studies the music of a group of people. And what that tends to mean is ethnomusicologists study music in the context of its performance. So we don't treat music as an object, you know, sort of to be taken out of context and studied, but as a social activity. So, and I would say more traditional methods, you know, analyzing the notes on the page, at the history, a historical context of the music are still significant tools in the toolbox. And I would say ethnomusicology just adds another set of tools drawn mainly from anthropology. We go into a culture, use participant observation, interview people about what matters to them about their music, and then often learn how to play in the style of whatever the group of people is that we're studying.
Well, ethnomusicologist is your role, and your focus is congregational music, and particularly contemporary congregational music. Mm-hmm. Where did your interest in a scholarly approach to that begin? How did that come about?
Yeah, well, I'd say say maybe a little bit before the scholarly approach came the questions. And I've been asking questions about congregational music in church. I mean, since at least probably I was a young teenager when my church was going through the struggles that some people call the worship wars. I think that term is a little bit of a misnomer in some places. I mean, my church never had a huge split, but certainly there were tensions over musical style that were happening, and I was observing these tensions firsthand as a young teen. And I remember feeling caught in between factions in my church. I found myself, I sympathized with some of the older people, and mind you, to me at that point, older was like people in their 30s and above, who were afraid of losing the music that they found the most meaningful. And I was and still am a fan of Fanny Crosby, of that kind of 19th, 20th century gospel hymn tradition. But I also sympathized with people my age and, people who were teenagers at heart. We went away to camp every year and had these powerful musical worship experiences with music that was, being led by bands that were made up of people close to our age, and with songs that sounded like, the pop music that we'd listen to on the radio. And I remember wondering then, why do I have to choose sides? Or do I have to choose sides? And so I didn't. Mm-hmm. So every time in church I was asked to play a piano solo, I would pair a hymn and a worship song kind of purposefully. And what I found was that both the traditional and the contemporary camps both loved it. And that opened up a whole other series of questions of, is this really less, about the songs or even the style? Does this have to do more with relationships? So, what makes music meaningful to people? What role do relationships play in that? Do sounds inherently mean things, or is meaning something that is derived from association, from context? How do sounds come to so powerfully symbolize ideas? And how can music be used to unite rather than to divide? I think these are some of the questions that started kind of bubbling up from my own church experiences that I carried with me to college, got some of them answered, then accumulated even more, and then to graduate school. And I found in my field in ethnomusicology a powerful set of tools and lenses to kind of to make sense of these.
Mm-hmm. What do some of those tools and lenses look like?
So I referenced a moment ago some of the key tools that ethnomusicologists use that I teach my students across level. Even my undergraduate students, they go into a church and conduct ethnographic studies, which ethnography involves a set-aside period of participant observation. Another thing, tool in the toolbox is conducting interviews. And one thing that I've found at Baylor, a really rich source that has enriched my understanding and practice of interviewing, has been the Baylor Institute of Oral History. Oral History has a wonderful, just a very well thought out method of interviewing that I've brought some of that into my courses and used some of it myself to elicit information in a way that's not simply asking people 10 questions on a page, mm-hmm. but is making sure that you get the same information that you can then compare across interviews. And then kind of lastly of all, and of course this is something that most, kind of field work based disciplines share, is the importance of documenting well what happens through photo and audio and video.
We are visiting with Dr. Monique Ingalls from Baylor Music and the Center for Christian Music Studies. And you mentioned asking questions and interviewing. And, to ask a good question is important and can also be a challenge, especially when you think about something like music, where
yes.
our tastes, a song we like versus one we don't like, could come down to, I don't know, the way we felt, the way we, our mood, the day we heard it the first time. What are some of the questions you try to ask to get information that's really revealing, that really gives you the kind of insight you want to have?
That's an excellent observation. And I think some of the key is it's less in sort of the kinds of questions you ask, but more in designing the environment in which you're asking those questions to be as conducive as it can be. And also in following up with people. I think the thing about ethnography is that it's not just a you swoop into a place and interview someone and get information, you know, from them and then swoop back out. It's a process of establishing a long-term relationship, because one of the things that I have found in interviewing people multiple times over the years is that that doesn't come as a surprise to any of us, but people's ideas change. People, in fact, sometimes people who remember, you know, the last time we had a conversation say, you know, that last time I told you this, I didn't really mean that, or I've changed my mind. And so I think what's important is to note that whatever questions you ask to, you know, to make sure to know that those are a snapshot of what someone thinks at a moment in time, and to keep that long-term relationship up so that you can see, you know, how that person's ideas change. And it's fascinating, too, you know, that it may just be one person's ideas changing, but if you keep up with multiple people over a series of months and years, sometimes you can observe changes coming in parallel, multiple people's ideas changing at the same time. And then you've got a whole new set of interesting research questions to ask.
Very interesting. Fascinating. We're visiting with Dr. Monique Ingalls, a Baylor Rising Star researcher, assistant professor of music at Baylor and the Center for Christian Music Studies. Well, let's talk a little bit about, in your research, some of the things that you find. What are some of the ways that you've examined music shaping people's religious experiences individually or in community?
I think when we think of church music or congregational music and people's religious experience, I think we're oftentimes thinking about what happens in a church service. And while that's, of course, incredibly important, and church services, as we know, form people spiritually, socially, emotionally, in such a variety of ways, I think one thing that that scholars haven't paid as much attention to, are starting to, is how what happens outside the church service. So one of the things I've tried to show in various parts of my research over the years is how the worship music people listen to and sing along with outside church informs the way they then experience music in church. So, for instance, how does singing church music that has a global reach and a highly developed commercial infrastructure shape what happens on Sunday mornings? I think one way, just to address that one question, one major way it's influenced church music is in shaping people's expectations, their aesthetic expectations, their theological expectations, expectations on a variety of levels. So if you listen all week to an expertly produced worship album on the radio or, recording, and then you sing that song on Sunday morning, if you're expecting the flawless vocals or the perfectly, you know, balanced mix of instruments or, you know, a virtuoso guitar solo, you're going to be disappointed, or you're very likely to be going to be disappointed. So if your experience of worship, if you equate what your feeling and what you're thinking and kind of your mode of relating to God in those private worship experiences during the week or at, say, large events, worship conferences or concerts, if your experience of worship becomes tied up with expectations of that kind of musical excellence that your local congregation can't provide, a couple of things might happen. And I've observed these things, you know, so one practical result is that small churches that can't, that don't feel like they can keep up, that may, you know, not have instrumentalists or only have a pianist that reads music and can't read a lead sheet, you know, these kinds of things. A lot of these smaller churches, and I'll use a term that a friend of mine, Steve, coined, become Vivo churches. So Vivo is the YouTube platform, you know, that a lot of artists use. And what he was saying is that going around to a lot of these smaller churches, he found that they wanted a particular kind of worship that produced this kind of worship experience in their churches, didn't have the instrumentalists to pull it off or to form a band. And so they started to simply play what was available on YouTube and to sing along with it. So kind of using YouTube as a worship karaoke track. So, I mean, that's in some ways an extreme example. Another example comes from a friend who studies who studies contemporary worship music with voting with your feet. So there's a recent congregational survey that shows that a full 10% of churchgoers in the U.S. today now attend a church with multiple campuses. So we're talking a large, I think mega church is defined as 2,000 and above. Some of these may not quite reach that that threshold, but we're talking about large churches, usually with a huge amount of resources to be able to spend on things like having a highly trained band and all of the equipment that you need to produce, you know, this music with excellence. So these churches have vast resources and can meet these aesthetic expectations of what worship music could sound like. And this colleague of mine was noting that several of his interviewees had moved from smaller churches to larger churches specifically because they could provide this musical worship experience that they weren't getting in their smaller congregations. So those are just a couple of examples of, you know, the ways that how people listen to and sing worship music outside the church structures their expectation and sometimes even the choice of the church that they attend.
As you uncover these things and as you know, whether it's journal articles, papers, or presentations, what have you, what do you hope, how do you hope people are able to process what you find and utilize it? What are some of the practical ways you want your research to benefit, whether it's churches or worship leaders or otherwise?
Yeah. Well, just to go back to what we were speaking of earlier with questions, I think the number one thing that I hope that my research does for practitioners, for people who are leading music in their churches, for pastors who are dealing with some of these tensions over music and worship style, I hope that my research causes them to ask questions that perhaps didn't that they wouldn't have otherwise. And I also hope that it gives them some interpretive lenses. I think sometimes we do things or we incorporate certain musical sounds or styles or, you know, whatever else. We adopt these things either without thinking through the implications. I think one of the things that my work shows is some of the implications from adopting certain forms of music. But then also considering the messiness of musical meaning, you know, that style, again, and say to lay my cards on the table on this, that music doesn't have, and music isn't inherently meaningful. We attach meanings to it. And as we've seen, those meanings can change over time. I mean, many conservative evangelical churches, you know, for instance, rock and roll was the devil's music, you know, in the 70s. And then the descendants, you know, these same churches or, you know, kind of their heirs, you know, are now using drums and guitar and fog machines in church with, and see no problem with it. So the meaning of musical style changes over time. And then one of the things I found as well is that music means different things to different groups. And so realizing, you know, that sometimes it's important for pastors and music leaders to realize that music doesn't have just one meaning and to find ways of ascertaining for their unique individual congregation with its own history, with its unique demographics, to figure out what musical styles mean to that congregation and how best to use that knowledge to minister to them.
Yes, well, we are visiting with Dr. Monique Ingalls, ethnomusicologist and assistant professor of music at Baylor and the Center for Christian Music Studies. We head into the final couple of moments on the program here. I wanted to ask you briefly, you've been going back and forth to England, researching gospel across the pond in the UK. What can we be anticipating with that as you move forward with that?
Yeah, well, so just to give a little bit of background, I lived in the UK for 3 years before I came to Baylor, and during that time, I met some gospel choir directors as part of. I taught a course on gospel music, and kept up with these contacts. And I, you know, a few years later, I was starting to think of some other potential projects. And I just there was something that kept drawing me back to British gospel choirs. And I spent some time, as one does, online, looking up these choirs, you know, kind of lurking on their social media pages, these kinds of things. And I was fascinated to see that there were a lot more gospel choirs than just 4 years ago when I had lived in the UK. They seemed to be springing up everywhere. There were some places like universities. University gospel choirs were on the rise. Cambridge had a university gospel choir now. They certainly didn't when I was, you know, there 4 years before. And many other universities, there were, you know, some really surprising places like rural Cornwall where there were gospel choirs. And I saw, too, that there was very little research on them. And so I started to conduct a few informal interviews with choir directors over Skype. And I found that for every question I had answered, you know, three more would crop up. So that's always a good sign for, you know, for something that has potential as a research project. And it really helped my project that the May 2018, the Royal Wedding, featured a phenomenal British gospel choir, a London-based choir called the Kingdom Choir. Their rendition of Stand By Me was heard by some 2 billion plus listeners around the world, so really put British gospel choirs on the map. And I traveled to the UK last summer and then earlier this summer to conduct oral history interviews with gospel choir directors. So one of the things that I'm doing is piecing together a history of this movement. So finding out who the important individuals, churches, and networks are that are supporting these choirs. And then I'm also aiming to find out what it is about these choirs that are creating, in many instances, very diverse choral communities. So gospel choirs in the UK are unique in that many of them bring together Black, white, and Asian singers, as well as Christians, people of no faith, and even people of other religions. So during my last trip, I met a practicing Hindu and a Muslim gospel choir member, and I've met dozens that insist they are not at all religious, but that something is going on when they go to these and sing gospel music that they can't quite describe. You know, some of them call it spiritual, some of them just point to the, you know, togetherness of community, but there's something special, something set apart about these gospel community choirs for them. So I'm aiming to you know, write a book about this to be completed 2024, and then I'm also exploring some what I find to be some exciting possibilities around in digital humanities, around an online digital resource. So like what I'm envisioning right now is a British gospel choir map that would be useful for people in these choirs and the general public, as well as scholars of this phenomenon.
What an interesting topic, and we'll look forward to that in the years ahead. And some of the other topics we've discussed over the last half hour, again, you can learn more about that in your book, Singing the Congregation, How Contemporary Worship Music Forms the Evangelical Community. Well, Dr. Monique Ingles, I wish we had more time, but enjoyed the conversation. Thank you very much.
Yes, thank you.
Dr. Monique Ingles, ethnomusicologist and assistant professor of music at Baylor and the Center for Christian Music Studies, our guest today on Baylor Connections. I'm Derek Smith. A reminder, you can hear this and other programs online, baylor.edu/connections. Thanks for joining us here on Baylor Connections.